Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI leaves Cyprus after a three-day apostolic journey with words of encouragement for the people of the island. Papal spokesman Father Federico Lombardi focuses on the three main themes and goals of Pope Benedict's Cypriotic visit. A major missionary conference wraps up in the Scottish city of Edinburgh, with hundreds of delegates of all the main Christian denominations searching for ways of working more effectively together in spreading the gospel message. And Father Jim Brand shares a poem and reflects on the fact that we pile on so many reasons why God shouldn't love us, but he does. Pope Benedict XVI's first apostolic journey to the island of Cyprus ended on Sunday with words of encouragement by the Pope to the people of the divided island. And early on Sunday, he symbolically delivered a 40-page working paper for a meeting of bishops from the Middle East at the Vatican in October. For decades, the paper says, the unresolved Israeli-Palestinian conflict, disregard for international law, the selfishness of great powers, and the lack of respect for human rights have disrupted the stability of the region and subjected entire populations to a level of violence which tempts them to despair. The working paper, known in Latin as the Instrumentum Laboris, will be the basis for 2 weeks of discussions between the Pope, Vatican officials and all the bishops of the Middle East regarding the future of Christians in the region. But for more on Pope Benedict's last day on the island of Cyprus, Vatican Radio's Charles Collins, who travelled there to report on the event, brings us more.
Pope Benedict left Cyprus on Sunday with words of encouragement for the people of the island. The country has been divided since 1974, with the Green Line dividing the Greek and Turkish sides going through the heart of the capital, Nicosia. During his stay in the capital, the Pope said he got a first-hand view of the division of the island.
Having stayed this past night in the Apostolic Nunciature, which happens to be in the United Nations buffer zone, I have seen for myself something of the said division of the island, as well as learning of the loss of a significant part of cultural heritage which belongs to all humanity. I have also listened to Cypriots from the north who wish to return in peace to their homes and places of worship, and I have been deeply moved by their pleas. Surely truth and reconciliation, together with respect, are the soundest foundation for the united and peaceful future of this island, and for the stability and prosperity of all her people.
The president of Cyprus, Dimitris Christofias, said the trip was a historic event of unparalleled significance, and said all Cypriots saw the Pope as a messenger of peace and a fervent supporter of equality. Before arriving at the airport, Pope Benedict made a visit to the Maronite Cathedral in Nicosia. Just around the corner from the Pope's residence during his stay in Cyprus, the Maronite Cathedral is also in the UN buffer zone. The Pope was greeted by the Maronite Archbishop of Cyprus, Joseph Suaif, who said the Holy Father's presence was a gift to the country.
Your presence here gives a blessing to our people, to Cyprus. We ask you to bless our families, our enclave people, who are signs of hope and strong faith, our youth and our children, so that they may always live in purity of heart and in the spirit of the gospel.
Maronites make up the vast majority of the Catholic population of Cyprus, although they themselves make up about 1% of the population of the island. The Maronites, along with the Armenian and Latin Catholics, are a recognized minority in Cyprus. The Pope urged them to hold strong to their faith and traditions in the country.
Maronites came to these shores At various times throughout the centuries, they are often hard-pressed to remain faithful to their distinct Christian heritage. Nevertheless, in spite of their faith being tested like gold in a fire, they remain constant in the faith of their fathers, a faith which has now been passed on to you, the Maronite Cypriots of today. I urge you to treasure this great inheritance, this precious gift.
Earlier in the day, Pope Benedict had published the Instrumentum Laboris, a working document of the Special Assembly for the Middle East of the Synod of Bishops. The Synod begins in Rome on October 10th. In Nicosia, I'm Charles Collins.
Thanks there to Charles Collins for that report. And someone else who's been travelling with the Pope to Cyprus is his spokesman, Jesuit Father Federico Lombardi. Before boarding the papal plane back to the Vatican on Sunday evening, Father Lombardi shared his thoughts with the journalists accompanying the Pope. Ema McCarthy has more.
Communion, dialogue and peace. According to Father Lombardi, these were Pope Benedict's three goals on his journey to Cyprus. And while communion and peace still seem unattainable to us, the path towards them is one of dialogue. Speaking to journalists, Father Lombardi pointed to the communion of the diverse Christian communities present in the Middle East. For Catholics, particularly local Cypriot Catholics, a message of fellowship and encouragement not to close in on themselves but to become better witnesses by giving a more visible testimony of the wealth of the ancient Christian presence in their lands that saw the origins of our faith. Dialogue and the Pope's encounter with the Orthodox, a further step, Father Lombardi said, on a promising path, but one which sees the shared testimony of the Christian vision of man become increasingly important. The fundamental values of the shared vision, commented Lombardi, are increasingly challenged and often radically contested. Theological differences, therefore, he said, should not allow us forget the aspects which unite us, which are far more important than those which still divide. And finally, the patient effort to announce peace despite the situations and incidents that cause concern and discouragement. The religious and spiritual mission of the Pope continues, he said, in the spirit of his journey last year in the Holy Land. The gospel is the inexhaustible source of hope for all capable of breaking down the walls of even the deepest divisions.
Nella nostra solidarietà spirituale, nel nostro impegno.
I'm Ema McCarthy.
Thanks there to Ema McCarthy for that report. Exactly 100 years ago, in June 1910, the city of Edinburgh hosted one of the most defining gatherings in the entire history of Christianity. The 1910 World Missionary Conference was a climatic event of the 19th century missionary movement, and it's universally accepted that that conference facilitated greater unity amongst the various strands of Christian witness. Well, since 2005, an international group has worked collaboratively to develop an intercontinental and multi-denominational project, now known as Edinburgh 2010. The project, based at New College and the Church of Scotland offices in Edinburgh, is headed by an international director and is governed by a 20-member general council, representative of most of the Christian family. And it has given life to this year's World Missionary Conference, an event known simply as Edinburgh 2010, Witnessing to Christ Today. My friend and colleague Philippa Hitchin has been attending the four-day Edinburgh 2010 conference, which ended on Sunday. She asked one of the participants in the conference, Archbishop Mario Conti of Glasgow, for an overview of the event, and also looked ahead briefly to Pope Benedict XVI's scheduled journey to Great Britain this coming September.
You're here attending this centenary conference here in Edinburgh, particularly significant because Scotland 100 years ago was a great centre of mission, of evangelisation, wasn't it?
Yes, if we go back 100 years, certainly, and go back to the conference that we're commemorating, we're aware that there'd been a strong missionary instinct among the churches of this country, particularly to send missionaries in the wake of the, what shall we say, expanding British Empire or the commercial interests And, of course, there were those who wanted to bring something more, and that was a sort of Christian Western civilization. And the great ambition then was to Christianize the world. But it was in the concept, wasn't it, of the Western Christian scene, the Christian entity. The Catholic Church at that time was still finding its feet in the post-Reformation period. What was interesting is that the missionary work, in a sense, was within the churches. Say in Glasgow, in the poverty there, it was being addressed by religious orders who came, the Marist Brothers, the Jesuits, the sisters, various congregations of sisters. And by providing education and providing pastoral work and supporting the poor and visiting the sick and what have you, they were really evangelizing, or what shall we say, addressing the needs of the native Catholic community, or the new Catholic community in the west of Scotland particularly. But the interesting thing is, in that 100 years since then, so many of those religious congregations obtained, if you like, or called from that community, those who subsequently therefore went abroad. So the many religious orders drew many vocations from within Scotland. Not alone, of course, we see it elsewhere in Britain and particularly in Ireland. But it was just at the turn of the tide, if you like, in that respect. So that we went here, you know, 100 years ago as a church. And it would be difficult to see how we could have taken our place then, because we would not have had the experience that we now have of the missionary endeavours of our people in going abroad, in going to mission countries, as it were, having learnt or having joined those missionary orders that served that post-Reformation community that was establishing itself in the cities of the Industrial Revolution.
Today, of course, the Catholic Church is a full member of the ecumenical movement here in Scotland, yes. Isn't it?
Yes, the Holy See speaks always about the one ecumenical movement, and it's something always to remember. I had the privilege for a number of years of being the co-moderator of the Joint Working Group, which is the liaison group between the World Council and the Catholic Church. So it enabled me to engage at that level and to get great experience of the ecumenical relations of the Catholic Church out with Scotland. But we have drawn on that experience. I'm not using the word poodle. The Church here, since the Second Vatican Council, has very largely responded to the insights of the Council. We've still some distance to go, but we've gone a very long way, I think.
Glasgow in particular had quite a bitter sectarian history, didn't it, of divisions?
Yes, and there's still sectarianism, which occasionally raises its head and often identified with football teams and their rivalries. I think perhaps in an exaggerated way, because that is where it's manifest, but I think it's probably deeper than that, and it's only in a manifestation of it there. The football teams are not the cause of it, if I can put it that way. They're the expression of it, and it's still to some extent there. But the churches don't, as it were, consider that that is anything but something for them to address, you know, so that the churches are not the cause of division within society. They are the cause of the resolution of those divisions, which in a real sense, yes, truly, stem back to the Reformation period, and particularly in Scotland, to what happened both in Scotland, but more particularly in Ireland, in Northern Ireland. And, of course, that is well known to people, I think, or increasingly well known to them, that it is something which is a division, which is not based simply on religion, though it is identified by different religions, by Catholic and Presbyterian, but they help to identify two communities, one of which replaced the other because it was planted by, you know, the British desire to colonise Ireland.
Looking ahead to the papal visit, of course, in September, yes. You're hosting Pope Benedict on his visit to, yes, Glasgow. Tell us a little bit about preparations in the city, how they're going ahead.
Well, at the moment, they're at one of those critical stages, you know, where we have to make some very important decisions. And yesterday I was torn between coming here and being with my fellow bishops in the standing committee, where we had to address some very particular questions, sort of questions that arise about security, about whether it's the best place to be, how we're going to cope with this or that aspect. But underlying it all, of course, is great expectation and a great joy at the possibility of the Holy Father, not only the possibility, the probability, hopefully the certainty of his coming, all being well. And what I have found particularly encouraging is the way in which the city itself, the city authorities, want the Pope to come. People of other faiths want the Pope to come. People will speak to me and say, I'm so glad the Pope is coming. It's what we need, we Christians, to have, you know, that focus on great church leader, you know, at a time when the church is up against, all the churches are up against, an increasingly secularist society. Secularist in part, I suppose, and that's the hardest part. But in another way, maybe the hardest part pastorally is the growing sort of apathy or distancing of people from religious faith or religious belonging.
Do you think a visit like this can in some way galvanize people, can rekindle that spirit of faith in a way that perhaps Scotland hasn't seen for many years?
I think so. I think you're absolutely right in proposing the question to me like that. And that's what our expectation would be. And those of us who remember the visit of Pope John Paul II in 1982 can remember how the development then of ecumenical relations took a quantitative leap, you know, and really that visit galvanized the ecumenical movement. And I can imagine that the same thing will happen again in giving confidence to the churches and hopefully giving confidence to do the very thing about which this conference is. And that is, you know, the working together to re-Christianize, to re-evangelize our society, to bring people to an intimate knowledge of Christ and not some sort of distant memory that somehow, well, you know, we're a Christian society, but of course we don't belong to any church now. Yes, we're religious, but not in that sort of way, you know. And how long can that be without the focus on the person of Christ and his grace?
What kind of message do you hope that the Pope can bring specifically to the city of Glasgow and the people there? It's really the heartland, isn't it, of the Catholic Church in this country?
Yes, that's a question I'd have to ponder a little bit. I mean, our expectations is that his coming will remind people of their Christian past. It's a time now when I think people will be quite content. It's, after all, the 450th anniversary of the Reform Parliament, 1560. Remind them that there was a division in society which changed the religious complexion of the country. And in the meantime, you know, the Catholic Church has grown enormously, largely through immigration, but not only. And one would hope that the Pope would be reminding us of the past, of the contribution that the Catholic Church had made historically to Scotland, which I think people are quite more prepared to hear today than they might have been in the past, in a more ecumenical climate. But also, I think, hopefully, to give us some sort of confidence or hope, vision for society. But the very fact that he will be the focus of so much attention and attention of the international press and, of course, the local press gives the church an opportunity, or the churches, to say something about themselves, about their history and about their mission.
The highlight will be an open-air mass, won't it? Yes. Tell us a little bit more about that, if you can.
Well, this is precisely what we're concerned about at the moment, is arranging that mass, which will be one of the biggest events during the course of his 4 days in Britain. And the city of Glasgow has offered us again, at the expense of the city, Bella Houston Park, where Pope John Paul II was received, and where the largest gathering of Christians in our history took place on that very lovely summer's day in 1982, memorable. And we're hoping that something of the same will occur again, but that's where we hope to have this mass.
You were there, were you, in 1982 in the park?
I was, as a young bishop. That shows how old I am.
What do you remember most? What are your lasting impressions of that occasion?
Joy. Joy, the song of joy, the enthusiasm of the people. It was a feeling that at last the Catholic community could hold its head up. It had gone through years of ostracism and so on historically, and even if people didn't use that word, there was a sense of it. It was, we've come home, here we are, look at us, here we are in this beautiful park in Glasgow. You know, we're not in the periphery of this country, we're at its heart, we're part of its community, we're making our contributions to its wealth, to its well-being and so on. And we feel that our fellow Christians are delighted for us. And I think there was this whole sense of joy, of achievement, of expectation, and great enthusiasm for the ecumenical movement, which took off at that point. Its energies haven't run out, but it'll be a good opportunity for them to be renewed, I think, in this visit of Pope Benedict.
That was Philippa Hitchin speaking to Archbishop Mario Conti of Glasgow. And Father Jim Brand reflects on the fact that we pile on so many reasons why God shouldn't love us, but he does.
Hello, it's Father Jim. And I thought I'd share with you a very short poem that for me is full of meaning. It's to do with we pile on all reasons why God shouldn't love me. And God says, but I do. And it's like a sort of game of tennis. You'll find in this poem, it's 15 love, 30 love, 40 love, game, set and match to the Lord. So I'll take the poem slowly and then I'll recite it as a whole at the end. It begins, it's by George Herbert. The Lord, love bade me welcome. Imagine us bouncing into the Lord's presence, you see. Hi, Jim. And as we look at him, we're confident. But when we start thinking of ourselves, we start getting depressed. It's like when somebody is learning to swim. Come to me, says the person who's teaching us. And we're looking at the person, you see. Once we realize, gosh, I am out of my depth, I, we start sinking. So in the storm on the Sea of Galilee, the Lord said to Peter, come to me. Peter's, he has started moving towards the Lord, but as soon as he started thinking of himself, he started sinking. Love bade me welcome. Yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin. So having gone to the Lord in first gear, forward, we crash the gears back into neutral and start reversing. As if the Lord's saying, hey, Jim, what's right? I've got a bad smell or something, you should run away. Oh, but quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me, sweetly questioning if I lacked anything. So the Lord says, you know, Jim, why'd you run away from me? Like Adam in the bushes, you see. Adam went rushing off to the bushes. When the Lord found him, he said, oh, I forgot my fig leaf. And God said, who gave you a dirty mind? I made you starkers. I love you starkers. You see, Adam was actually too proud to admit that God still loved him. He thought his sin was too big for God to forgive. And what's more, he accused God, you don't love me. That's a terrible thing to say to the one who loves us. Because it blocks any love coming in, you see. And his motive was chastity. Oh, such a modest person. It was pride parading as chastity, modesty. So we start going into reverse. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. Now we start piling on the agony. What I, the ungrateful. Oh, my dear, I cannot look on thee, so take my glasses off. Make myself blind, you see. I can't look on you. Because I made myself blind, love took my hand. Smiling did reply, but who made the eyes but I? We've been given eyes to see him. Now, in this life, we dare not see him as he is, because it would just blow our retinas. When Moses had a glimpse of God, he had to put on Polaroids. And the next time God went by, he tucked Moses into a little crack in the rock. Because if we saw God as he really is, it's just too much, as the Americans would say, too much. It's only veiled in flesh, the Godhead, to see now. We can only see him veiled in each other. I mentioned before that our Lord's body was his modesty clothes. He only unzipped once at the Transfiguration. And Peter went bananas, you know, let's build high-rise flats here, went crazy. Because we can't see God's glory and survive in this life. We only see him veiled in each other, in flesh. A guest I said worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. Now we start piling on the agony. What, I? You know, notice the I. The unkind, the ungrateful. Oh, my dear, I cannot look on thee, you see. So love took my hand and smiling did reply, but who made the eyes but I? And it's only if we see him veiled in flesh here in this world that one day we might see him as he is. We see him in each other, especially in the weak and the poor, and the pitiable, and the little, and the little things. O truth, Lord, but I've marred them. Let my guilt go where it doth deserve. Talk about piling on the agony. By the way, it's 30 all now. He's winning. Know you not, says love, who bore the blame? Oh, help. Okay. Oh, then I'll surf. You know, give me dustpan and brush. Give me a drying up cloth and I'll go into the scullery in heaven. You must sit down and taste my meat, says love. So I did sit and eat. He wore me down. He wants to serve me. He wants to sit me down. And he wants to serve me. Now, to me, this is what the sacrament of reconciliation is about. I pile on all the reasons why he shouldn't love me. He says, I still love you. But I did this on the 49 bus, still love you. I did this on the Sabbath, still love you. He's going to win game, set and match. And so all revelation is a dialogue, according to Paul VI, who I hope will be canonized one day. Wonderful man, that Pope. He kept the church together after the council. He's going to win. So here's the poem by George Herbert. Love bade me welcome, yet my soul drew back, guilty of dust and sin, but quick-eyed love, observing me grow slack from my first entrance in, drew nearer to me sweetly, questioned if I lacked anything. A guest, I answered, worthy to be here. Love said, you shall be he. What, I? The unkind, ungrateful. Oh, my dear, I cannot look on thee. Love took my hand and smiling did reply, who made the eyes but I? Oh, truth, Lord, but I've marred them. Let my guilt go where it doth deserve. Know you not, says love, who bore the blame? My dear, then I'll serve. Oh no, you'll sit down, says love, and taste my meat. So I did sit and eat. Alleluia. Amen. He'll win. Game, set and match.
That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow. So join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.